Welcome to the Blue and Orange Nation Talking Mets podcast. This is Vinny with my co-host, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Vinny. How are you tonight?
Very good. Very good. We'll be talking about all things Mets here tonight. We're going to be joined by a very special guest, Mike Vaccaro of the New York Post, talking about the team and, of course, talking about his quote-unquote blowtorch column from last week. We also have Artie from Brooklyn joining us as well. A lot of things to talk about, Mike. I guess the first thing we should talk about is the Mets' recent West Coast road trip, which I know everyone looked forward to, you know, pretty nervously. They traditionally have not done well on the West Coast. They had struggled before they got out there. There was the series against the Cubs at home that they got beat. So everybody was really worried about this trip. We were thinking it could be the beginning of the end. And what happens, Mike? They turn around and win both series, you know, 2 out of 3 from the Dodgers in L.A., 2 out of 3 from the Giants in San Francisco, just to continue with the Jekyll and Hyde, can't figure this team out, unpredictable season that we have. And instead of it being the beginning of the end, it left everybody here on this off day with only 3 games to go before the All-Star break feeling pretty optimistic, Mike. Who would have figured?
It's good. The Panic City level has been returned to blue. We're just guarded. Everything's okay. And, you know, we're feeling pretty calm. I think that, although you're right, it's been Jekyll and Hyde as far as wins and losses. It's really been such a steady state game by game. You know, that comment, win or lose, you tend to say to the person that you're sitting next to, "This is the same game I watched yesterday." You know, the games are very similar, and we win some of them and we lose some of them. Basically, nobody scores for a long, long time, and somebody somehow scores. This last game with DeGrom, our old friend the Era came back to help us out. And, if we score at all, we're right there, right? We got a shot.
Well, 2 things happen, Mike. The game usually ends with a 0. We just don't know if the Mets are going to have the 0 in their column or whether it'll be the opponent's column. And the Era, you mentioned the Era, and the Wednesday game, the final game of the San Francisco series, had the Era in also both of the usual areas. We scored a run on an area and an error, rather, and Daniel Murphy made an error. So we kind of had what you would expect. We checked the box. We scored a run without a pitch. We made a bad play on the infield. We had great starting pitching. You know, it really does work that way. It is pretty amazing. But here we are. You know, again, the surprising part, though, if we were going to say there was a script, Mike, the script was play well at home and play poorly on the road. That has been the script, I guess, so far. Yet the Mets got beat by the Cubs. They lost 3 at home to the Cubs, which was against their norm because they had played very well at Citi Field. And then they went on the road where they struggled, to the West Coast where they struggled, and they won 2 out of 3. And I actually read, I can't remember which player it was, Mike, but one of the players said that it, you know, gave them confidence to win these games on the road. So they're aware of it too. But, you know, so that has, there's 3 games left before the All-Star break at home against Arizona. And if the Mets do, and the pitching matchups are great, the Mets do have Syndergaard, Harvey, and Matz as their final 3 pitchers before the All-Star break. And, you know, they take 2 out of 3. You go into the break feeling pretty good. We're still wondering how they score some runs, but you do go into the break feeling pretty good. And it would, and this is a recurring theme I know, Mike, you would think that if you go into the break winning 2 out of 3, being about 3 games out of first or the wild card, which is where you'd probably be if you won 2 out of 3, that it would give more incentive to the front office to make a move to get some offensive help in here. Of course, that remains to be seen, and that's one of the topics that Mike Vaccaro, our special guest, is going to talk about. But you would think, Mike, that it would really put a little bit of extra pressure on Sandy to get his cell phone charged and maybe either answer the phone, or get this, Mike, make a couple of calls to opposing GMs to try to get, I know that's a pretty, a novel idea for Sandy, but to actually reach out and try to make a deal.
Yeah, I think there's just, you know, it is, there's so many places in the lineup when you see the daily lineup where you find, you know, an easy upgrade. You know, whenever Campbell's out in left field, I understand you get a home run later in the game on Wednesday. But you know, Eric Campbell in left field, you just, you know, he can't play the position well. We know he can't. You know, he's pretty much done a great job of proving he can't hit at the major league level. I mean, it's just a lot of major league outfielders that can be an upgrade there. And I have a feeling we could end up with an outfielder after all, which changes the mix of the ability to make a deal, because, you know, I'm really starting to wonder about Kadire. I mean, they gave him the shot. They said that was either going to be the answer or it wasn't going to be the answer. You know, a lot of us, myself included, have probably had some experience with cortisone shots. They're not always really effective. I mean, they're just, you know, they're anti-inflammatories. Depends what the underlying issue is. And he ended up missing a lot of time on this trip.
No, and that goes, we could get into the comedy of the Mets' injury diagnosis, that this one fits the narrative of he's fine, he could play tomorrow, he does play, and the next thing you know, they're saying, you know what, he probably should go on a DL. It looks like we're heading that way. But even if, just take a little bit of a leap of faith and say that Kadire is healthy, it is nothing, and he can play. What about just improving the bench? I mean, our friend Michael Barron tweeted out the other day that the Mets pitchers have a better batting average than the Mets pinch hitters. That's amazing. Now, the Mets pitchers are pretty good hitters, Mike, but we're talking about the Mets pitchers were batting 160-something and the pinch hitters were batting 140-something. So it's not
right,
that our pitchers
included every... Yeah, it included every pitcher. I did happen to see that, and I thought, wow, I mean, that's just an incredible statistic. And so, you know, theoretically, it could show that even if you're going to take a pitcher out of the game, you know, you should let them bat. I mean, you know, yesterday they pinch hit Newman Weiss for DeGrom, and you really have to say to yourself, is that smart baseball? I mean, I know it sounds nuts.
Hey, Terry knows.
I don't know what's, you know, up is down right now. Down is up. It's a strange situation. Another tweet I saw, it wasn't from Michael, or it might have been, but I apologize because I can't remember who it was from, so I can't, you know, I'd love to cite the source, and I can't mention that the team OPS, which was under my, you know, Adonis line of 600, it was like 566 for the month of June, some number that just, you know, you can't believe you look at the number five times, was lower than the Cardinals pitching staff OPS for the same month of June, so... Right, this is legendarily bad offense on a daily basis. And legendarily good pitching, by the way.
That's true, and I want to get to that. But before we flip over to the pitching side, the last comment I want to make for now about the offense is that's why when we talk about make a move, you know, a lot of the folks, especially the, you know, New York sports talk radio crowd, says, I don't want to trade Syndergaard or Mats. So, we can't make a move. Well, you know, when you see those kinds of numbers, you realize that the basically anyone, you know, I saw people denigrating somebody like Delmon Young on Twitter today. And believe me, Delmon Young is not that good. But when you realize that our pinch hitters are batting 140, you say to yourself, could Delmon Young hit better than 140? Well, it feels like he should, or at least he could. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying he's the answer. I'm just saying you don't have to trade, you know, Syndergaard and Mats and guys like that and shoot for the Tulowitzkis of the world. If you really wanted, you know, pick me up somebody who's been DFA'd. Give me somebody on the bench who might bat better than 140, Mike. I mean, that'll make a deal. You know, we're talking about marginal upgrades, but if you know what, if it doesn't cost you much, why not? Might win you a game or two.
Yeah, I mean, some of the it's hard to understand the lack of transactions. And we're so inactive on the transaction front. I was really trying to figure out why we would possibly have re-picked up Newman Weiss on waivers when you waive. But we don't pick up anybody else when they're put, you know, on waivers. Like, why why are we so in love with our own rejects? I don't, you know, I just think just for kicks you would try somebody else's reject. Change of scenery, that idea. You know, that you already know these guys have failed you. I really don't get it.
And I don't want to start early, Mike, with the bashing of the Wilpons
right.
and Sandy. We end up there a lot.
Right.
But, you know, if the idea is that the Wilpons are very cheap, at some point do they say, why are we paying Sandy Alderson $4 million or whatever his reported salary is? Pretty hard to find, Mike. But, you know, estimates are he probably makes about $4 million a year. Why are you giving Sandy Alderson $4 million a year to do nothing? Couldn't you pay somebody the GM minimum to do nothing? And if the Wilpons was so cheap that they were broke, they can't keep the lights on, that's like $3 million that they could use to pay the bills instead of having a guy do nothing. I don't know why the Wilpons don't think that way at some point.
And I'm going to let that hang there just for now, because I know we're going to get into some of that with our interview with Mike later, and I don't want to go over the same stuff. My thoughts, more than once tonight. I do want to say, there's no debate tonight. There's really nothing to discuss. I think for a lot of reasons, including his very deserved choice of being a National League All-Star, Jake DeGrom has got to be on Met of the Week this week.
No question, Mike. And what's really amazing about DeGrom is, I know he won the Rookie of the Year last year. And, he's got the hair and he gets, the T-shirts and some things like that with his caricature and stuff. So I'm not saying he's totally, under the radar. But, people seem so focused on Matt Harvey coming into the season and early in the season that, DeGrom was a bit of an afterthought, even with the success he had. And even with the success he had at the beginning of the year, people were still focused on Matt Harvey. And, Matt Harvey has been good. He hasn't been, exceptional, but he's been good this year. And just now, I would say the last couple of weeks, people are starting to turn their head a little bit and realize, hey, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't all be focused on Harvey as the guy. DeGrom is the guy, too. If not right now, he's even better than Matt Harvey is. And again, I'm not really trying to put down Matt Harvey. Matt Harvey's great. But I'm saying let's remember how good DeGrom is and what the season he's putting together. He doesn't have the one loss record, but when you look at his whip and his ERA and his strikeouts, even they were a little bit down at some point, but he's ramped it back up the last few games. He's right up there with the kind of guys you should be considering for starting the All-Star game or getting into the Cy Young conversation. I know that there are some pitchers who are having phenomenal years, like Zach Greinke, Gerrit Cole, and some other guys who are really, have some gaudy stats. But, DeGrom, pitches like he has been. I know that's a lot to ask. He's got to right be in that conversation, Mike.
Oh, Jake's pitched great. And I think he is getting, more and more recognition. I mean, he won a rookie year last year, and now this year he was, he's clearly recognized by the rest of baseball with this All-Star, with this All-Star choice. And it's he's been a great story, as we've said. I mean, it's not that he was considered like a bum in the system, but of all these pitchers, of all of them, even Matt's now got a certain amount of hype before he came up. DeGrom was more... that we had some injuries on the staff. He was going to be brought in to help shore up the relief staff. And then there was another injury last year. And they said, we'll have him make a couple of spot starts. And to his credit, right, he just sort of produced at a level to say, he kind of wally pipped the whole thing. He did the, I'm going to make a couple of spot starts. I'm never leaving this rotation. He hasn't looked back.
That's a great point. And I love that because it kind of throws – the whole prospect analysis thing on its head, because everybody thinks they know who the next star is. And look, Matt is an example. Syndergaard is an example of that. Sometimes that's right, but examples like DeGrom and even to a certain extent on the offensive side, somebody like Lagares point out the other side that says, you just don't know with some of these guys. You just got to put them on the field and find out. And because of that, it makes me think that, you know, maybe guys like Tovar and Reynolds in the minor leagues, sometimes, you know, you should just throw them out there if you have an opening, because you just don't know what you have. And, you know, maybe there'll be a flop, but you know what? Maybe they'll catch lightning and you'll realize you got a player there.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's only way, right, everybody doesn't get the chance to, you know, pump to the major leagues. It just doesn't work like that. They have to do a certain amount of producing in the minors. And DeGrom did. I mean, he absolutely had, he was pitching fantastic at Vegas, too, last year, you know, before he came up. But you're right. I mean, as far as a lot of times you just, you know, you never know, and that's what makes the game fun, that you really don't 100% know.
All right, Mike, I think we should go to our guest now. We have this has actually been pre-recorded. We spoke to Mike a couple of days ago. But we have Mike Vaccaro from The Post. We're going to talk to him about a lot of things, some of the things about the Wilpons and things that are being covered. But let's just get Mike on right now. Is the great beat writer for the New York Post, covers the Mets. He's great work all along, but in particular, we're going to want to talk to him about a recent article that he wrote, which he used the term, and Mike, we love this term, the blowtorch that he took to the front office and ownership of the Mets for their actions, or I guess better put, inactions that have taken place recently. Mike, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, it's good to be here with you guys.
So, Mike, before we talk about the blowtorch article, you know, this team, you know, we talk about it as fans. For you to cover the team, this is a great team to cover because, I mean, there is something, you know, newsworthy either on the bazaar side or on the field side, you know, on a daily basis with this team. It really is amazing. Give us your take on the season so far, the ups and downs that you've witnessed to date.
Well, I think the difference between, you know, what writers consider fun and what fans consider fun is a pretty vast gap because I think, you know, a fun season for the fans is a season like 2006 or a season like 1986 where, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have a pretty good feeling your team's going to win that night and the league's going to go from 8 to 10 to 12 to 15. That's fun. Less fun is the ups and downs of the season, which is what you mostly have, you know, most teams have, you know, season after season. I think that's what you have this year. I mean, you have a team. Obviously, there was 10 games over 500 right out of the gate, and it's kind of been, you know, significantly less than that since then. But, you know, it's a team that really, if nothing else, they find a way to keep you on your toes because, you know, you think they're on, you know, on the way to having a slam-bang homestand last year. They get swept by the Cubs. Then you figure they go on to the West Coast, and their season's going to die on the vine, and they win three out of the first four games on the coast. So it's that kind of a team. To me, that's a fun team because if you never know what's going to happen, that makes it kind of ensures it's never going to be boring. Now, I'm sure fans would like a different kind of definition of fun. And I think that probably fans have a different definition of boring because sometimes it's lineup can actually be the very definition of boring. But, you know, I think that for the first 82, 83, 84 games, it's been a hard to predict team. And, you know, they almost demand you to watch because you never know what you're going to see. And sometimes that's not always for the good.
Yeah, it really is funny, and we've talked about this before. It's amazing how a team – I can't remember seeing a team like this, that the starting pitching is so, you know, a plus-plus asset compared to the rest of the league, yet virtually every other element of the team, base running, lineup, bullpen except for Familia, bench, is, you know, I guess abysmal is probably the only word that could come to mind. It really is amazing how unbalanced this team is.
I guess it really does kind of, you know, back up the old axiom about how much percentage-wise pitching is to your team because the fact is that certainly if you just go by run differential, they're not as good as they shouldn't be as good as their record is. But just by the eyeball test, I mean, if you just had, you know, good pitching, this team would be 10 games under 500 probably. If you had very good pitching, you're probably 5 games under 500. I mean, this is an exceptional situation because, you know, so even during this 6-man rotation, I mean, you kind of think you're going to get pretty good efforts for those 6 days, and you kind of take your chances with Cologne and Nice. Well, Nice has been terrific the last 4 or 5 starts, was superb against the Giants and was great against the Cubs last week in a losing effort. Cologne's coming off, you know, 7 shutout innings against the Cubs, and he's certainly capable of giving you, you know, 0, 1, or 2 runs any given time. So, as good as the Mets have been pitching in their history. I mean, it's going to be hard to think of a time when you were so excited every time one of their starters went out. And it's not just because they're good, because they're young, because they could be stars, but it's also because that's just keeping you in the game. You know, it seems like it's a Twitter joke now. Whenever the other team scores the first run, people try and beat each other to say the game is over. And it's funny, but it's not funny because you really do have that sense because of the struggle the lineup has had and because of the frustrations, you know, the pitchers must be feeling. I mean, yesterday is one of the few times, you know, John Reese exits the game 0-0. He figures there's no decision. And then they want to score three runs. He wasn't getting the win. So that's something you very rarely see for the other pitchers. So that didn't make him feel good. But you're right. I mean, there are so many aspects of this team that are lacking. But it's amazing, you know, when you're throwing out a good starting pitcher, you're going to be in the game for the first 6-7 innings of every game, and then you can take your chances. I mean, two of the games of this trip, they've won because they were able to hang around over the ninth inning in the mountain ninth inning rallies, once in L.A. and against the Giants on Monday night. So that's what good pitching will do for you.
Yeah, and Mike, because of that, you make the point about how you're in it every game. Because of that, that kind of segues into kind of the frustration that you feel as, you know, as a fan, that if they were able to just even a moderate upgrade to the offense, you would think would go a long way, because then you really would be able to win a lot of these games. And that's kind of gets into the article that you wrote stating, you know, that, you know, Sandy, I think you used the word malpractice between Sandy and the Wilpons for not being able to go out there and make some kind of moves to address the shortcomings of this team. And you know, before we get into the article, which we thought was brilliant, by the way, but we have on this show spoken in the past that we'd really like your perception, because you have being part of the media, you let us know if you think differently. We have perceived that if the collective vibe from the media is, you know, the Wilpons are either broke or cheap, one or the other. They either can or won't spend. And woe is poor Sandy. What can he do? He's got both hands tied behind his back. And so all fault for the team seems to be, well, that's the Wilpons. What do you want? They have no money. That's the perception of the reporting that we've, in general, picked up over the past few, you know, probably a couple of years. It's not been to us until very, very recently. Your article, I think there was an article shortly thereafter, one of the other papers, with a similar vibe, that started to perhaps put a little bit of the blame on what the heck is Sandy doing here. Do you think it's fair for us to say that we think that the media in general has been blaming the Wilpons and giving Sandy a bit of a pass?
No, I think that's pretty accurate, and I'll say it this way. I think the Wilpons ultimately are responsible for whatever happens in their team, and clearly we all know what happened with the Madoff situation. We all know what's happened with the debt they've been facing the last 6 years. And I honestly think the Mets fans would have been more patient with them if they'd been honest with everybody and said, look, we don't have any money. That's the way it's going to be. And, you know, if they would have defiantly said, but we still plan on keeping the team, a lot of people would have been angry. But at least there would have been an element of honesty to that. So I think that it's clear that the ultimate responsibility falls to the Wilpon. And as a result of that, I do think that there is a sense that there's only a limited amount that Sandy could do. All that said, and look, I understand. I mean, it's hard being a general manager when you know you're not going to be a contending team for a number of years. And that was the situation facing him the first 4 years of the team. And I think he was smart to build up and to not fall into the trap of, well, we're only four games out of the wild card. Let's make a deal. I think that element of it was smart. And I think it's also smart that he controls these five pitchers for as long as he can, unless somebody's willing to make an unbelievable trade with him. But that said, you know, when you start to hear some of the things he says and some of the ways he reacts and some of the things he says, you know, it almost seems something to some degree like he's trolling the fan. And that's where you start to wonder about is he doing everything he can? And look, I mean, no one is saying that they should part with any of those starters. I think that would really be malpractice, especially if it's kind of a deal. I mean, I think Mets fans still are smarting from the Scott Kazmir for Zambrano trades, you know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago. You know, no one's asking for that. You know, the Mets are a team that's been defined by trades like Amos Otis for Joe Foy and Nolan Ryan for Jim Pagosi. Look, you don't want one of those. But you can't tell me they couldn't have gotten Uribe without some kind of creativity from the general manager that would have involved, you know, a slight upgrade in salary, a slight commitment in salary, a couple of spare parts. And that's the kind of player who would have been a perfect fit the last couple of months with David Wright unable to play. I mean, that's the kind of thing I think that many of us are talking about now. And his unwillingness to do that, and in fact, his glib response when people ask, when are you going to do something, I think that's what's, you know, either frustrating or infuriating, depending on what your point of view is.
No, and you used the word creativity, Mike, and we've talked about that here. I mean, that's the thing that gets us. I mean, we talk about the Wilpons being cheap. That front office is not cheap. I'm sure Sandy doesn't work cheap. He's got Depot. He's got Ricciardi. You know, those guys, you know, they're probably a pretty big-ticket front office. And can the Wilpons be happy with the level of creativity that they're supplying? I mean, people are – it's not done every day, but the Oaklands, the Tampa Bays, you know, usually when you have no budget – you have to be creative. The Mets kind of have the nexus of no creativity and no money, which makes it even tougher. That being said, Mike, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's kind of like the Animal House line, right? Fat, drunk, and stupid is the way to go through life. You know, being poor and uncreative is a tough way to get through Major League Baseball.
That being said, Mike, do you think that, you know, here we are, you know, there, whatever, I think they're 3.5 out of the wild card right now as we get up today. Do you think that there will be some kind of move made? If, you know, if you were a betting man, would you think that Sandy would actually pull something off between now and the deadline or shortly thereafter?
Look, if they're where they are now, which is clearly well within shouting range of both the division and the wild card, by, say, July 20th or 21st, and the trading deadline is 10 days away. I'll put it this way. If he doesn't do something, and I don't know how he remains viable as a GM, and I can't imagine the ownership, like you said, would be willing to stand by and be the scapegoats because, you know, if he does nothing, the automatic assumption would be, well, he wasn't allowed to. His hands were tied. They have no money. And that may well be true. But other teams make deals. Especially at that time of the year, I think it's understood throughout baseball that the five pitchers are off limits. But there are other pieces within the Mets system. You know, let's call it six guys. Let's say that the six untouchables right now in their operation are the five starting pitchers and Michael Conforto. And look, every team's got untouchables. And that changes if you're talking about getting Paul Goldschmidt. But assuming you're not going to get Paul Goldschmidt, you know, you're looking for guys of the ilk of, say, Uribe or Ben Zobrist or whatever. And those guys will cost a couple of prospects. It will cost the willingness to take on some salary, which will limit how many prospects you have to give up. But look, I mean, if you're not going to go for it when you're within shouting range, then how are we supposed to believe that they're going to go for it in the offseason for 2016 or next year if they're in the race? And so here's the thing. You know you're in this year's race. You already know that. And you've already kind of squandered 6 weeks when you could have tried to bulk up your team and, you know, if not stay closer to the Nationals or to the Cubs, maybe to surpass them. You chose not to do that. You know, who's to say that after 85 games next year that both the Cubs and the Nationals aren't, you know, 45-20? You know, it's a whole different story. Both those teams have allowed you to stay closer to them this year. And if you're not taking advantage of it, it just, you know, that's when you start thinking about words like malpractice, because to me, the objective of a guy like Sandy Alderson is when you identify yourself being in a place where you can actually make a move, you got to make that move. And he hasn't done that. He hasn't shown a willingness to do that. And unless he changes the way that he's operated for the last few years, it's hard to say with any certainty they're going to do it this year.
No, and that's great. And Mike has a question, but before I let him go to that, I have one follow-up on that. If they do not make a move and they fall short, you know, the combination, no moves, and they miss the postseason, they finish with, you know, I don't know, name a number, 82 wins, and they miss out, do you think, you know, Sandy moves to the hot seat?
I guess it's assuming he's not on the hot seat now. I think he's on the hot seat among guys like you and me and fans. Probably not so much as bosses yet, which is, you know, I think another source of frustration. But, I mean, I think he would have to because, look, at some point you have, you know, what they would do, the way they would spin it as well, we keep going in a positive direction, 78 to 82, and then next year who knows where we'll go. And that's fine, but, you know, I think what a lot of people are going to see if they wind up, say, at 83 and 79 or whatever, is they're going to look and say, you know what, that's a team that probably let 5 or 6 wins get away from in June and July, or, you know, in May and June. And, you know, if you finish 2 or 3 games out of a playoff spot, you know, how do you answer to that? And I would think that would be a thing a general manager would have to answer for. My suspicion is that the guy who will wind up answering for everybody's problem is Terry Collins. And, you know, as I mentioned in the column, as I've written plenty of times before, I don't necessarily think that Terry Collins is, you know, John McGraw or Tony La Russa, but I also don't think that it'd be anywhere close to being fair if he winds up being the guy who takes, you know, the brunt of the blame. But that's the way it happens, right? Especially when you have a strong GM and you have stubborn owners, the guy who's going to take the blame is the manager, and that's ultimately going to be, I think, the hot seat we're going to see if they wind up with 82 wins or if they don't make the playoffs.
And Mike, we've talked about it here. If Terry goes and he's replaced with Bob Guerin, I can't see how any reasonable person thinks anything will change. You know, that's change for change's sake, in my opinion. I don't see how that would make a meaningful impact at all, which is disappointing.
Mike, it makes you wonder what it would be.
Mike, you have a question for Mike?
Yeah, just one quick one. Mike, again, thanks a lot for coming on with us. One thing I also read the other day, you wrote a nice column about how it's not so easy for fans to just, you know, boycott teams, to just forget about it all. Because, you know, you hear that a lot, too. Like, hey, if Mets fans don't like it, don't go, don't watch, don't do this, don't do that. Like, it's so easy to just turn it off. And, I mean, you know, fan is short for fanatic. And if the whole thing doesn't really make sense, but we all root and do it. So I don't know how that can ever work as an answer. I think one of the things, to get to my question, has made this such an overwhelmingly frustrated time to be a Mets fan, and I go all the way back, and there's certainly been bad teams before, is you mentioned how you feel sometimes like Sandy's almost trolling the fan base. And, you know, we believe it stems from the owners, this whole what I would call culture of misinformation. In particular now, you never feel like you're getting the truth as far as injuries go. Do you think that's a fair gripe, that we're being legitimately misled a lot of times with the extent of how bad a player is injured?
Well, gosh, Mike, I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe it's the reason, maybe because the last 10 or 15 guys have been injured follow the same pattern. Always fine, MRI, DL, and then the DL step, and then it's never 15 days in the DL. It's always 20, 25 days. In the case of David Wright, it's more than that. I mean, it's absolutely fair. I mean, and this has been going on for years. And it's
and this predates all of them.
It does, and that's the thing. And one of the things that was assumed that Sandy was going to do, he used the word culture, was change that. I mean, it's nonsense every single time. You know, it's amazing. Don't worry about it. He's fine. You know, and when you do have an aberration, like Kadire doesn't wind up on the DL, or Familia doesn't wind up in the DL, you think, well, what happened? Because it just, every other thing follows the same way that Travis Darno injury was. You know, he's fine. We had a couple of days. Oh, wait, we're going to double check. Now we're going to put him on the DL. And you know, if it happened once, you'd say, well, that's understandable. If it happens twice, well, that's bad luck. When it happens 37 times, it speaks to something that's really wrong in the operation. And you know, it is. I mean, right? You laugh because if you don't laugh, you're gonna throw your coffee mug against the wall. What is that song? it does make you wonder what's the purpose for underselling their injuries. I mean, they've been doing this going back to Ryan Church. You know, and it makes no
right.
sense. And the thing of it is, I mean, the doctors who are involved are all competent doctors, renowned doctors. Everything they do in their practices beyond the Mets is always considered, you know, high-end stuff. And yet the Mets somehow, you know, drag them into where you wonder if they're quacks. Well, they're not quacks. Quacks are the people who are somehow misidentifying these injuries. It's a very strange thing that goes on with this team year after year after year, and it never changes.
Yeah,
it really
is wild. And on a serious note about it, I mean, I've had some medical procedures. I haven't went to personally, but I mean, the hospital for special surgery is world renowned. So it's hard to believe that the problem is stemming from the hospital for special surgery, as much as we all make jokes about it.
Yeah, it's definitely not. I mean, that's the thing. And it extends beyond two different GM administrations and three different managers. I mean, it's absurd. It's bizarre. And, you know, I'm not saying that's the reason why they've been in this morass for 7 years, but, you know, it's certainly an aspect of what makes the Mets seem like a Keystone Cops movie every morning, you know, more than just occasionally.
You know, before I let you go, just one last question. You know, that element and you know, Sandy's trolling and a lot of this stuff, do you think there's even, you know, an inkling at some level of the organization about the perception that people think that some of this is either a joke or insulting? Do you know, like the Dolans know and don't care. Do you think that there's any knowledge in the Mets organization of how they're perceived?
I think there is a rampant arrogance among the ownership. I think there's some arrogance in the general manager's office. And I think that when you have that level of arrogance, you believe, you know, with every ounce of your being, that everyone else is the one who's nuts, that you're the one who's sane. And I think I think ultimately that's the problem. I mean, there's also a problem that they're broke right now. But, it wasn't long ago they were willing to spend. But they also thought, you know, they were willing to spend, but they also still believed then they were the smartest guys in the room. And I think that's a problem. I think that's an institutional problem. And I think that, you know, even if tomorrow that all their financial woes went away, you're still talking about people who operate without any kind of humility. And I think that's a problem. You know, I think that even like the mightiest of the mighty, George Steinbrenner, you know, he didn't have the late in the game success he had until he was humiliated and humbled. And he might have come back with the old bluster, but just judging by his performance over the last, you know, 15 years of his life, it wasn't anywhere close to the way it was from, say, 1979 to 1990. I mean, it was different. He was fundamentally and profoundly humbled by what had happened to him. And I think that was one of the best things that could have happened to the Yankees. I think one of the best things that could happen to the Knicks is if James Dolan – I'm not rooting for James Dolan to be taken down by a con artist the way that George Steinbrenner was. But it wouldn't be terrible for there to be a moment of humbling where he realizes that maybe he doesn't have all the answers and he's got to rely on competent people. And I think that that's the kind of same kind of thing that has to happen to the Dolans, whether it's a lightning strike of anything. You would have thought that the Madoff thing would have humbled them. But if anything, you know, it's allowed them to, you know, seize kind of a martyrdom theme, and it really isn't very becoming and it doesn't work and no one's buying it, but, you know, that's the one they're going with, and they think it's the smartest way to go. And, you know, as always, they're the smartest guys in the room.
And we as fans are left hoping that they somehow are vindicated and it all works out. It's a pretty strange thing. You know, we don't want to go through another rebuild and have them be, you know, exposed as having this all fail and blow up. We'd rather have Sandy somehow miraculously say, gee, I told you so, rather than wait another 5 years to try to get out of this. It's kind of funny.
Well, it's true. It's true. I mean, you talk about the fans. You know, everybody thinks that guys like me live to write columns like the one I wrote last week that you referred to, the Blowtorch article. You know what? I'd rather never have to write that. I really would. Trust me, it's better for business from the New York Post standpoint to write about winning teams. It's better for the Post from a business standpoint to write about the Mets in the World Series than the Mets in another stage of chaos. It just is. People think that we live for the negative. We don't. We go negative when it's necessary because that's how we operate. We far prefer to be able to celebrate than to criticize. And the thing with the fans, you mentioned the column I wrote last week, and it's, you know, to me it's one of the most fascinating things in all of society, is the way that you choose your teams, and, you know, that usually happens early in life, and you stick with them. And look, you can say to yourself tomorrow, I'm not going to root for the Mets anymore. I'm going to be a Padres fan. And you can go through all the motions and watch all the Padres games and care, but you're not going to change your heart. And if your heart cares about the Mets, you're going to care about the Mets. And that's the fans' burden, is that you go through bad ownership, you go through incompetent managers, you go through lousy players, all with the hope that, you know, it'll be worth it if you get a magical summer like 1986. You know, even if you get a year like 2006, I mean, yes, it ended badly, but I don't think there's any Mets fan who would trade in, you know, one of the days from April through Carlos Beltran's at bat, you know, tomorrow. I mean, that's what you hope for.
Mike, this is Mike. I've said many times, if people would step back and think about it, I would trade many, many years for 2007 and 8, as bad as those last games were. There was a lot of fabulous baseball those years.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, the question I've asked many Mets fans the last 7 years, would you rather have your heart stomped? And I mean, it was stomped in 07, and it was even worse in 08 because you had to sit there doing a closing ceremony at Shea, having just been eliminated from the playoffs.
Yeah, that was tough.
Would you rather have that, or would you rather have a season that ends in June, which is what you had a lot of the last couple of years? And, you know, I mean, you know, if they're taking truth serum, the obvious answer is no, I'd rather have my heart broken because it means that I had a full baseball season. And, you know, those are special, even if they end badly. The worst kind of thing is to, you know what it's like as a fan. You know, you don't want to care in September when they're 20 games out, but yet you're watching the score. You're watching inning here and inning there. And the feeling you're feeling is wistfulness as opposed to passion, and you'd rather have the passion 100 times out of 100.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Mike, listen, we really want to thank you again. Mike Vaccaro, New York Post, great work. We really appreciate you coming on, and let's hope that you're going to have those positive things to write about over the next couple months.
That sounds good. I had a good time talking to you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
So that was Mike Vaccaro. That was a great spot, Mike. He really had some great things to say. And if you guys haven't seen the article that we referenced, I think it was published the end of last week, but I'm sure you could find it online. It was really good, and it really expressed kind of the frustration that a fan would have, Mike, rather than just a journalist, about, you know, the inaction and what would seem to be kind of the maybe apathy of ownership in the front office, and that now's the time to act. I mean, it was a great article, and that was a great spot from Mike Vaccaro.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike does a great job all the time. In fact, he does a solid job with baseball this time of year, and a good job with both the Knicks and local basketball in the winter. So just an all-around good columnist and a good read.
No, and look, I think, you know, it leads to what we had started to talk about right before we played our interview with Mike, which is, you know, if they stick around, you know, if they don't make a move, it's really going to be disheartening. And we've talked about it on previous shows that the fan base is kind of beaten down. But you wonder how much more they can take. But if you get through the deadline and you just get, you know, more of the same kind of sandy explanations about the market, and we didn't see anybody that was worth the value that we would have to give, all that kind of talk, we get that instead of somebody who could actually put the bat on the ball, it's gonna take the heart out of even some of the fans that are left here. And just for that reason alone, and believe me, I'm not as on the one of those guys who says make a move just to make a move. If you just factor that in, you would think that the Wilpons would actually push for some kind of move. I'm not talking about Tulowitzki money. I'm talking about a smaller move. And you and I have talked about it offline, Mike. I think it's much more realistic that the people that are the Mets are targeting are people like Ben Zobrist, people like Martin Prado, people like Gerardo Parra, those kinds of guys who I think are more likely and more affordable and fit. If those are the kinds of guys that they're looking at that would cost, you know, marginal prospects and marginal salaries, I my gut tells me something like that is going to happen. What are your thoughts, Mike?
If I had to stick a finger up in the air, I actually would expect it's going to be a move. I probably wouldn't bet on it being huge for a lot of reasons. I think, you know, I do think that, I can see why it would make sense that they don't want to trade any of the big pitchers. I think depending on the player, I don't know how I would feel, but I do think that there's almost institutionally they don't want to do it. And that takes them out of a lot of players, no matter what, you know, no matter how the dollars match up. And I also, it's probably, you know, until we're shown otherwise, it's hard to believe there's going to be a big dollar transaction. But there are ways to do this at this time of year, depending on how much prospect you give up. Sometimes you have a team will eat a lot of the salary. And as we know, you know, maybe some, again, the numbers are so hard to understand whether they can rub a few nickels together or not. So maybe we don't have to, you know, when guys like Parra and Zobrist and Prado, you know, we might actually be able to pick up the salary. There's a lot of tickets still to be sold. When we went to that Cub game last week together, there's only 24,000 people there. A lot of those people there are on discounted ticket deals. There's still a lot of revenue to sit out there that they would think they want to try to pick some of it up. They're there. They're in a situation where they could really, you know, build some money on the other side of the ledger for themselves without a lot of expense. And you would think that would be attractive to the Wilpons. So I think they will be pressuring for a move of some sort. And I would say if I had to make a prediction, I do think something will happen before July 31st.
I'm with you, Mike. I agree for the same reasons that you just stated. Let's switch gears a little bit. We talked a little bit earlier about Jacob deGrom making the All-Star team, well-deserved, of course. I think most fans expected there would be another All-Star on the team, being Jairus Familia. He has had a phenomenal year, and if you think about, you know, he had a great year as a setup man last year, but, you know, when Mejia got, you know, was injured on opening day, actually, we really thought we could have some trouble with the bullpen. You know, he has stepped in and been, you know, a better closer than we would have expected Mejia to be, frankly. And, you know, he's up for the final man voting for the All-Star game, which I think it ends tomorrow, and the latest results are he's fifth out of five. So it really doesn't look good for him. But, you know, I'm kind of surprised myself, Mike. I know a lot of times this is about numbers and about everybody having a representative and blah, blah, blah. But I can't imagine, you know, as far as closes go, that other people have the kind of seasons that Familia has had. He's definitely deserving in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the keys being that he's made a lot of relief appearances for saves. So he's been great. And a lot of closers, of course, have had solid years. But the fact that he's had to come in the eighth inning as many times as he has and actually get out of, you know, situations with men on base, you know, he hasn't had as cushy a closer situation, I would imagine, as anyone. I think he's probably been put in more difficult positions than any other closer in baseball, especially one with his success rate. So I think he was very deserving, and I'm disappointed. Of course, there's still a chance he'll end up on the team. A lot of people usually end up, you know, not being able to appear who originally selected.
Yeah, that's a great point. But, you know, I kind of want to know what our friend Artie from Brooklyn thinks about that. Artie, you're on the Blue and Orange Nation Talking Mets podcast with Vinny and Mike. What do you think about this Familia situation being not being picked for the All-Star team?
I'm going to tell you what I think. If it was a Kansas City Royal, you know he'd be voted in right now. But we can't get enough people to even vote for the poor guy. That's number one. Number two is, you know, when Lee Mazzilli was in the All-Star game and I was sitting there rooting, he should have won the MVP, I didn't realize that years down later, one of our guys is going to get screwed because of that stupid rule. But think about this, okay? The Phillies and the Brewers have to have one representative, even though he's not their best guy, all right? They could have brought in that rookie in Philadelphia and have him in there. They could have had Gomez from Milwaukee. And both of those guys are not even close to being as good as the relief pitcher. And I don't know who it was, okay? But maybe you guys can remember. There was a guy that went like 10 times, and I don't even think he was on the same team. And he backed down and said, you know what, let this guy, he's well-deserved. And Familia, who the heck knows what's going to happen? Those two guys have been there so many times, especially K-Rod, okay? The least they could do is say, you know what, Familia had a better year than I did, let him go to the All-Star game. That would be the noble thing. It's probably in their contract that they get another $100,000, even though he's getting paid like $15 million, all right? So he's going to go to the All-Star game. And Papa Von God forbid, nice. So, I don't know. It just bothers me to no end. I mean, he's the best reliever in baseball right now. And he's not going. It's not right. It is not right. All right, now a little vent. And here's the other thing with the Wilpons, Mike, okay? They're making money because it just was on one of those TV stations. that they're doing some outlets right across from Citi Field. They would rather pay the $300 million to that and know that they're going to get money in their return than put $300 million into somebody like Stanton. And that's the truth, all right? That's what it comes down to. All right, guys. Love you guys.
Thanks, Marty.
I got a little breaking news here, Ben, that I wanted to jump in on that came through on the wire as we've been broadcasting. Carl was on. Which is that Stephen Matz has been is going to miss a few weeks, it says here. Steve will miss several weeks with a lat strain. I know I had heard on Sunday that he was pitching with some of the lat strain. Apparently they're going to shut him down for a couple of starts. And again, I hate to make the joke, but we discussed it with Mike earlier on the podcast, right? You know, you just hope that a couple of starts doesn't end up being, you know, arthroscopic surgery. But lat strains are not supposed to be terrible injuries, and we'll hope for the best with Steven.
No, well, look, a couple things about that. First of all, you know, I do recall reading that he had this problem prior to and leading up to his last start, which he pitched a shutout, I believe. Not a complete game shutout, but he pitched great. So I'm not quite sure that it's the kind of thing that we should be overly concerned about. You never want any of your pitchers to be hurt, but this can't be ridiculously serious if he pitched with it and pitched well. I'm not saying we continue to put him out there, and you're disappointed that he's not going to be pitching, you know, on Sunday, but unless this is another one of these Mets, we can't trust what they say, I'm not thinking that this means the end is near. I think, you know, with the All-Star break coming up, there's a good chance that, you know, even with our crazy rotation, if you think about it, if he was supposed to pitch on Sunday, which would have been, I guess, 6 days from his prior start, we have the All-Star break of 4 days. He could go, you know, he could go almost, you know, 17 days between starts to let this heal and not really affect him that much.
This could just be about when it starts, yes.
Yeah, it could be, and even if it becomes, you know, 20-something days, Mike, nearly a month, it might be two starts. So I'm not going to get too upset about it as far as injuries go, only because we had heard the rumblings before, and he pitched through it, and he pitched great. And you would imagine that having, you know, the potential for, you know, plus or minus 20-ish days off to heal it shouldn't be a huge factor.
But I mean, Matz is a lot of fun to watch, and so selfishly, of course, I'd like him to be able to make all the starts because I'd like to watch them. But, you know, if there's one area of clear depth right now on the team, it's starting pitching, right? So this should be something that they can clearly, you know, overcome, whether he's out for 20 days or 30 days or even a little, you know, longer in some way, shape, or form. So it will be interesting to see. After listening to Sandy's, I think it was like 45,000-word dissertation about how the six-man rotation was here to stay when Matz came up, if he misses more than one start, you know, whether we really stay with the six-man rotation or not. Because if we don't, then you know, they weren't really committed to it. So we will get to see how committed they really are to the six-man rotation.
No, and you know what else? Just something else that come to mind. Last season, I don't remember what the injury was, Mike, and maybe your memory is better than mine, but we gave Jacob deGrom a DL stint on an injury that wasn't necessarily that serious, and it was kind of viewed in hindsight now as giving him a little bit of a siesta because of, you know, wanting to cap his innings limits and things like that. I'm not saying this is not a real injury. I'm just saying maybe it's another way for them to say, you know what, if this was the last week of September, we might let this guy pitch if it was a, you know, an unbelievably important game. But, you know, maybe it's not the worst thing in the world for this guy to take a couple weeks off. That might be a factor here, Mike.
Yeah, and I do remember that we had to, you know, take DeGrom out of rotation for a short period around the same point in time, if I remember correctly, maybe a little later in the season. I do remember that in May of last year. That's how DeGrom ended up in a rotation. But Dylan G was placed on a disabled list with the same exact prognosis, a lat strain. So I don't know if that should make us feel better or worse, considering, you know, how things have went for G since. So, but, I mean, he's pitching, so we can look at it as, I guess it wasn't that big a deal, but he hasn't pitched terribly well since, you know, since that time. So I'm not trying to be the law on this, but I don't think it's known, that's known to be a big, you know, a terrible injury.
I agree. Well, that's good. Well, you know, again, I don't think, unfortunately, with the trials and tribulations of Dylan G, anything that you try to make a comparison to him makes the hairs on my neck stand up. But I hear you. I definitely hear you. But I'm,
and,
I know, I'm,
and Dylan G, we might see a little bit more Dylan G now. I mean, that could also be, if they decide that they're committed to the six, he seems to be number six.
Well, I wonder if that means Dylan G pitches Sunday. He doesn't have to. I think the way that the rotation shakes out, who would be...
Especially with the day off today, remember.
With the day off today, it could be whoever pitched on... who pitched on Monday? Who pitched the first game of the San Francisco series?
Nice, correct?
Yeah, Nice. So I guess it's possible that Nice could just pitch on Sunday.
I would think it's probable, because I also think that they have enough time. I mean, it's only Thursday, and they already know this. So as far as preparation, right, because we know pitchers are creatures of habit, Nice would seem to have plenty of time to prepare for this start on Sunday.
Well, we shall see. But, again, I'm going to stay positive. I'm not going to let this one get me down. So, anyway, we're about out of time. So, you know, look, for right now, there's three games left for the All-Star break. We're looking for the Mets to finish strong. And then we have the All-Star game with at least Jacob DeGrom on the team, possibility of Familia, of course. And then they come right out of the gate afterwards with a road trip where they play, the Mets play in St. Louis and in Washington, and then come home to play the Dodgers. So, you know, if they can finish strong, they come right out of the gate, they'll have some very important games. It'll be very interesting to see, Mike. But I'm personally looking forward to it. I think this is what we want. You know, we don't want to play in that, the Marlins all the time and beat up on them. We got to play these good teams and beat them. That's the way it's got to be for us to really feel confident that this team is going somewhere. So I say bring it on.
You're you got two wild cards. That's part of the mix here. And so every above average team is competing with every other above average team for some spots in the postseason. So yeah, you can't rely on everybody else to beat them. So you have to beat them. So I agree. I think those games we always like meaningful baseball, and that makes the games a little bit more meaningful. And I look forward to them.
No, that's great. So that about wraps it up. I'd like to thank our very, very special guest, Mike Vaccaro from the New York Post. I'd like to thank Artie from Brooklyn. Mike, next time we'll get back to you, we'll probably do a session probably right around or right after the All-Star game. We'll have to figure out scheduling what makes the most sense. But hopefully we'll be right either start in the beginning of that series, the important stretch of games, or in the middle of it. We'll have to check to see. But thank you very much, Mike. This has been a blast.
Had fun.
And we'll catch you soon. And as always, let's go, Mets.